children for the worst. Christmas, 1942. During the past weeks, all of us have begun to think about the end of everything. The insignificance of everyday life pales against this, and we have never been more grateful for the Christmas gospel than in these hours of hardship. Deep in one's heart, one lives with the idea of Christmas, the meaning of Christmas. It is a feast of love, salvation, and pity on mankind. We have nothing else here but the thought of Christmas. It must and will tide us over grievous hours. However hard it may be, we shall do our utmost to master fate and try everything in our power to defeat the subhumanity that is wildly attacking us. Nothing can shake our belief in victory, for we must win if Germany wants to live. I have not received any mail from you for some time. There is a terrible longing for some dear words from home at Christmas, but there are more important things at present. We are men who know how to bear everything. The main thing is that you and the children are all right. Don't worry about me. Nothing can happen to me any longer. Today I have made my peace with God. I give you all my love and 1,000 kisses. I love you to my last breath. Yours, Carl. Affectionate kisses for the children. Be dear children, and remember your father. Oblivious to the noise in his bunker, Lieutenant Emil Metzger sat reading a letter from his wife, Kata. It was the best Christmas present he had ever received, and at 10 p.m., he quietly withdrew from the celebration to go out into the clear, frosty night where a lonely sentry walked his post. Metzger relieved the shivering man of the responsibility and shouldered his rifle. He wanted this time alone. Under a bower of brilliant stars, he paced back and forth, ignoring the Russians and the war. Concentrating intensely on Kata, Emil relived their life together. The first dance when they fell in love, the exhilarating hikes through the cathedral hush of forests, the 4 brief days of honeymoon they shared before he rushed back to duty, the furlough he had given up in August because he believed the war was about to end. For over an hour, Emil held a spiritual communion with Kata beneath 1,000 miles of stars. It was the only gift he could give her. While German soldiers sought escape in celebration, their generals were discussing the diminishing prospects of Sixth Army's salvation. Teletype, General Schmidt, General Schultz. Dear Schmidt, tonight the Field Marshal and we are all particularly thinking of the entire Sixth Army. I do not have much new information for you today. Hoth, the German relief column south of the Kessel, is still engaged in defensive operations. It appears that the enemy, around Vasilevska at the Mishkova, has received further reinforcements. As regards your situation, we still did not receive a decision from the Supreme Command of the Army. The Field Marshal wants you to know that you had better reconcile yourself to the idea that the solution will in all probability be thunderclap. Even Field Marshal Manstein did not believe this anymore, but Schultz did not have the heart to deny Schmidt one last hope of freedom. We are waiting for better weather so that we may commit all available airplanes to provide you with the necessary fuel and provisions. What's new on your side? Schmidt was querulous, demanding, is it certain that the airplanes can start although Tatsinskaya is threatened? Schmidt did not know that Tatsinskaya was already in Russian hands. Schultz lied. Their start is ensured, and alternative airfields were prepared. Sensing that Hoth's relief attempt from the south had already failed, Schmidt asked, will Hoth be able to hold the Mishkova River section? Schultz, we hope so. However, there is a possibility that he will have to narrow the present bridgehead. At that moment, the bridgehead had already been evacuated by the German rear guard. Schmidt, was an armored division withdrawn from Hoth to the west bank of the Don? Again, General Schultz was unable to strip his friend of hope. One armored division, the 6th, which had left the previous evening, had to be withdrawn to the west bank of the Don in order to protect Morozovskaya airfield. However, as of tomorrow, the SS division Viking, a fully motorized division, will be arriving in the area of Salsk by train and road. Besides, we have again urgently requested considerable reinforcements from Army Group A in the Caucasus, but we are still waiting for the decision of the Supreme Command of the Army. I have nothing else. The Commander-in-Chief and I cordially return your Christmas greetings. During Christmas Eve, the Stalingrad front remained alarmingly quiet. Little was heard from the Russians, except the squawking of loudspeakers urging the Germans to lay down their arms and come over to good food, shelter, and friendly Tartar girls. Crouched in their snow holes, German soldiers still listened with detached amusement to the propaganda. Most of them feared the Russians too much to trust such alluring proposals. In the early hours of Christmas Day, a violent blizzard broke over the Kessel. Visibility dropped to less than 10 yards. 50-mile-an-hour gusts howled across the Balkans, and the men of 6th Army slept off the effects of wine, cognac, and rum. But at 5 a.m., the Katyusha rockets screamed in a multitudinous cadence as thousands of flaming missiles soared from beyond the perimeter into the Kessel. Heavy-throated mortars and artillery also overwhelmed the moaning wind. The ground heaved and trembled under a ferocious cannonade. And then, out of the gray-white, appeared tank after tank, and in between, trucks crowded with infantry. In the sector held by the 16th Panzer Division, groggy soldiers climbed from their bunkers to fight a desperate delaying action. The attack had come too fast, and Russian tanks and soldiers were suddenly among them in the swirling mist of snow. Opposing infantry fired its shadows indiscriminately, dead men heaped up in front of field guns. German 88mm artillery crewmen quickly ran out of ammunition and blew up their pieces with the last shells before retreating to a second line of resistance. As the morning of Christmas Day passed, 6th Army intelligence officers stated positively that the Russians suffered a frightening number of casualties, but they also had to acknowledge that they too had absorbed similar, shocking losses. The battle blazed on into the afternoon as, on the other flanks, Russians smashed against the reeling but well-dug-in 6th Army. The entire Kessel reverberated to the terrifying sounds of thousands of big and small-caliber weapons. At his overcrowded hospital, Dr. Kurt Reuber paused in his treatment of patients to conduct friends to the door of his private quarters. When he pushed it open, they sucked in their breath at what they saw. On the gray wall facing the door, a lamp illuminated a picture of the Virgin and Child, whose heads inclined protectively toward each other. Both were shrouded in a white cloak. Reuber had labored secretly for days on his surprise. Perched on a stool, he had scrawled several themes on bits of paper until he remembered a verse from St. John about light, life, and love. The words gave the doctor the ideal image, the Virgin Mary and Jesus, who best symbolized those qualities to him. Several times Russian bombardments scattered his pencils and artwork, but the doctor doggedly retrieved them and created the Madonna and Child of Stalingrad on the back of a captured Russian map. Now, as fellow officers maintained a hushed vigil in front of the drawing, Kurt Reuber drank with his friends from his last bottle of champagne. While toasting each other, a series of trip hammer explosions rocked the room, and Reuber rushed outside to the cries of dying men. In minutes, his chapel became a first aid station. One of the officers who had just left Reuber's party after singing the carol O du Frohlicher was brought in with massive wounds. He died under the picture of mother and child. At Gumrock, Arthur Schmidt was absorbed in another frustrating exchange with his friend in Novocherkassk. 25 December, 42. 1735 hours to 1800 hours. Here, Major General Schultz. Is General Schmidt there? Yes, sir. General Schmidt here. Good evening, Schmidt. We hope Christmas wasn't too bad for you and the entire army. On Christmas Day, 1,280 German soldiers died in the Kessel, and Schultz had more disappointing news for 6th Army. All day today, Haute, south of the Kessel, was compelled to ward off heavy attacks by superior enemy infantry and armored forces. Major casualties were inflicted on the enemy, but there were also considerable casualties on our side. although bridgeheads in the Axai section were compressed, the section itself could be held. According to reconnaissance results, the enemy has assembled yet another armored corps in the area and southeast of Axai. There can be no doubt that the enemy has concentrated major forces in the space between the pocket and Hoat. We have not yet received a decision from the Supreme Command of the Army regarding our proposals for further operations with the objective of relieving the 6th Army. General von Richthofen told the Field Marshal, Manstein, today that, if the weather should improve, he will be able during the next few days to supply the 6th Army with 120 tons of supplies daily, and later on with 200 tons daily. The decrease in the amounts is due to the increased distance the aircraft have to cover from Novocherkassk and Salsk, new shuttle airfields. I wished, in particular today, I could give you better news. The Field Marshal is still trying to get approval for armored forces and motorized infantry from Army Group A to be brought up to 4th Armored Corps as speedily as possible in order to facilitate thunderclap for the 6th Army. What's the situation on your side? Arthur Schmidt dictated the stark facts to the operator, who typed them into the teleprinter. Today we suffered fierce attacks against Boundary 16th Armored Division and 60th Motorized Division on a small frontage, which temporarily led to a penetration on a front of 2 kilometers and 1 kilometer depth. On the whole, the counterattack was successful, but the Russians are still holding the frequently mentioned and important Hill 139.7. We hope to regain it early tomorrow. The Army's provisions and fuel have decreased dangerously. In view of an icy east wind and very low temperatures, we need a considerable increase of rations. Otherwise, we will have numerous men on the sick list from exhaustion and frostbite. We cannot manage with an air supply of 120 tons daily. Measures must therefore be taken to increase our supply rapidly, or else you might just as well forget about the 6th Army right away. Is Hoat still in the Mishkova section? Schultz still refused to admit that the bridgehead over the Mishkova River had been abandoned. Hoat holds the Axai section with small bridgeheads north of this area. At this point, Schmidt indulged himself in some sarcasm. According to information we received today, some of the aircraft which were intended for our supply were again ordered to fly combat missions. In the opinion of the Commander-in-Chief, Paulus, this is very unwise. Please do not regard our supply situation too optimistically. We suggest that the Luftwaffe should rather supply us with bread than drop a few and not always effective bombs before the Tatsinskaya front. I have nothing else. Schultz hastened to reassure him of Army Group's continued interest. Believe me, your supply situation is our greatest concern. I shall immediately and again report to the Field Marshal on the situation, and he is in constant contact with Richthofen and the Supreme Command of the Army, with the aim of increasing your supplies. We are aware of your desperate situation, and shall do our very best to improve it. I have nothing else. Please give my regards to the Commander-in-Chief. Until tomorrow. Schmidt. I have nothing else either. Greetings. Ending. As General Schmidt signed off, it was finally clear to him that the German High Command had lost control of events in southern Russia. The entry in 6th Army's War Diary for December 25, 1942, reflected that fact. 48 hours without food supplies, food and fuel near their end. The strength of the men is rapidly decreasing because of the biting cold. We hope for food soon. No decision as yet on battle plan for the 6th Army. Lonely German soldiers spent the last hours of Christmas twirling radio dials to pick up shortwave broadcasts from home. On Christmas Eve, many had listened to the popular singer Lala Anderson as she sang special requests for the troops. Now, on Christmas night, the men of Stalingrad were treated to Propaganda Minister Joseph Goebbels' Ring broadcast, supposedly originating from the frontiers of the Third Reich. It was aimed primarily at the civilian population. While Goebbels chanted the names of conquered cities, the German people toured the battlefronts. "And now from Narvik," he announced grandly amid a rising chorus of male singers stationed at that Norwegian port, "and in Tunisia, brought forth another strident rendition, this time of Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht, from soldiers holding American and British troops away from Bizerte and Tunis. And from Stalingrad, Goebbels suddenly said, while thousands of soldiers inside the Kessel stared at each other in disbelief, a joyous melody burst from the radio to assure the home front that all was well at the Volga River. Goebbels continued with his fabricated broadcast, and his voice shrilled out the impressive boundaries of the Nazi Empire. But most of his countrymen trapped on the Russian steppe had already turned off their radios. Chapter 24. Buoyed up by the false hope that Manstein was coming, the soldiers of the Sixth Army had endured the rationing and freezing weather with a remarkable stoicism and elan. However, when Christmas brought the sobering realization that the Kessel was probably going to become their grave, physical and moral defenses began to crumble, and the gaunt occupants of Fortress Stalingrad started to lose their ability to hold out. Drastic measures instituted by Paulus to preserve the food supply only added to the decline. The beleaguered general had no choice. Once again, the airlift had failed to step up deliveries beyond 100 tons a day. The teletype that night recorded the bleak facts. Today, December 26th, by 5 p.m., we received 38 JU and 3 HE transports, carrying 70 tons, among them food, mainly bread. We have only enough bread for 2 days, edible food for 1 day. Fat is gone already. Complete food supplies must be flown in immediately, in balanced proportions, for 250,000 men. We depend only on what arrives by air. We are also out of fuel. Tomorrow we will give out the last 20 cubic meters. I beg you by all means to see to it that tomorrow 200 tons be flown in, 150 of which is food, 50 cubic meters in fuel. Otherwise, we shall not make it. We shall do our utmost. Colonel von Kunowski, Paulus' chief quartermaster, added a final comment. No more from here. I never sat so deep in shit. Kind regards. Paulus had known for several days that he would have to cut rations again, but he had waited for Christmas to pass before announcing a near-starvation diet. Bread, 2 ounces per day per man, a piece the size of a man's thumb. Soup without fat, one portion, for lunch. 1 can of tinned meat when available for dinner. Otherwise, more watery soup. The stringent rations struck a mortal blow at the stamina of his men. Painfully aware of that fact, Paulus attempted once more to remind his superiors that an entire army was on the brink of extinction. Erich von Manstein received his chilling words and passed them on to Hitler. Bloody losses, cold and inadequate supplies have recently made inroads on division's fighting strength. I must therefore report the following. 1. Army can continue to ward off small-scale attacks and deal with local crises for some time yet, always providing that supply improves. 2. If enemy draws off forces in any strength from Hoth's front and uses these on Stalingrad Fortress, latter cannot hold out for long. 3. No longer possible to execute breakout unless corridor is cut in advance and army replenished. I therefore request representations at highest level, Hitler, to ensure energetic measures for speedy relief unless overall situation compels sacrifice of army. For the first time, Paulus mentioned the nagging possibility that Sixth Army might be used as a sacrificial pawn in this maniacal game of chess in order to tie down as many Soviet units as possible while Manstein tried to stabilize his other fronts. One of Paulus's aides, Captain Vindrik Baer, broached the same opinion in a remarkable letter to Major Nicholas von Below, who was Hitler's adjutant at Rastenburg. The two men were old friends and were married to sisters. They had always been honest with each other, and Baer now provided his comrade with a uniquely frank and intimate glimpse of the atmosphere at 6th Army headquarters in Gumrock. Dear Klaus, at the moment we feel somewhat betrayed and sold out. To wait and to persevere is a matter which goes without saying, even if no further orders come through. I just want to tell you quite simply that there is nothing here to eat, with the exception of a few thousand horses, which may last until January, but with which one cannot alone feed an army of 250,000 men. Now there is only bread for tomorrow. With my knowledge of the German soldier, we have to foresee that their physical resistance will be lowered so much, the moment will come where each man will say, I don't give a shit about anything, and will freeze to death or be captured. The men have the desire to hold fast, and it is incomprehensible how they have held so far. Heating is a very big problem. Everything has to be fetched from Stalingrad, but there is no gas available for that. In other words, the cat eats its own tail all around. It may have been decided in view of the situation to give us up, which is not unthinkable, although it is hard to fathom the consequences. If so, I will live a few days more with Eichlepp, a fellow aide. Thanks to your excellent chocolate. I write this to you, Klaus, so you don't think that we are griping unnecessarily. What I am telling you is based not only on my personal experience, but also on messages and daily conversations with friends at the front. It is as bad as I say it is. No miracle in the steppe can help us here, only good old Aunt J.U. and the HE-111 transport planes, if they come, and come often. Otherwise, the mood is and has been good here, a little running scared, but there is still hope amongst enlisted men and officers. Stand fast, the Führer will get you out, is the motto. Here at the top, especially on days like this one, looking into an empty barrel, the responsibility lies heavy. Teddy. Like the sudden rupture of an umbilical cord, the teleprinter link between Gumrak and Novocherkassk was torn asunder, as on the steppe west of the pocket, Soviet armor captured the decimeter relays maintaining the fragile semi-personal contact between Schmidt and Schultz, Paulus and Manstein. The severed connection left 6th Army with a single 1,000-watt transmitter and several auxiliary sets of lesser strength to communicate with Army Group Don. Some German officers inside the pocket looked on the abrupt blackout as an augury of ominous days. In Moscow, Stalin fumed at the delay in destroying 6th Army. Though his front commanders continued to relay news of heady triumphs from other sectors of the battlefield, the Premier refused to relax. On December 28th, General Vatutin at Soviet Southwest Front headquarters along the Upper Don contacted him with news of an overwhelming victory. The Italian 8th Army's right wing had melted away, 60,000 prisoners and about the same number killed. Their stores have been seized by our forces. The pitiful remains are not putting up any resistance. Stalin absorbed this exhilarating report without much enthusiasm and immediately pressed Vatutin on the one danger zone in his command region. Around the great German airfield at Tatsinskaya, where General Martin Fiebig had fled the wreckage of his shuttle air force only 4 days previously, a Russian armored column was temporarily trapped by lead elements of the German panzers rushed from their aborted relief effort at the Mishkova River. Stalin chose this moment to lecture Vatutin on strategy. Your first task is to get Badanov, commander of the encircled 24th Tank Corps, out of trouble. You were right in allowing him to give up Tatsinskaya in an emergency. We have already given you the 2nd and 23rd Tank Corps to convert Little Saturn into Big Saturn. The drive to Rostov and the Black Sea that Russian General Krupinikov hinted at to his interrogators on December 21st. You should bear in mind that over very long distances, tank corps are best launched in pairs rather than alone. Otherwise, they risk falling into a situation like Badanov's. Just remember Badanov. Don't forget Badanov. Get him out at any cost. With that final admonition, Stalin left Vatutin to manage his own little war between the Don and Rostov and went on to his most perplexing situation. Paulus's 6th Army, whose continued existence tied up 7 Russian armies needed elsewhere. Meeting with his senior generals, the Premier came right to his major complaint. Only one man should direct operations. The fact that there are 2 front commanders around Stalingrad is interfering with this. When everyone at the table agreed, Stalin asked, Who gets the assignment? Marshal Georgi Zhukov remained silent as someone recommended Lieutenant General Rokossovsky. Why don't you say anything? Stalin prodded Zhukov. In my opinion, either commander is capable of doing the job. Yeremenko's feelings would be hurt, of course, if you transferred his Stalingrad front to Rokossovsky. That point was shrugged off by Stalin. This is not the time to worry about hurt feelings. Telephone Yeremenko and tell him about the decision. When Zhukov called Yeremenko and explained the situation to him over a high-security line, the pugnacious general felt his professional world crumbling around him as he heard, "Transfer the 57th, 64th, and 62nd armies from the Stalingrad front to Rokossovsky's control." Yeremenko recovered enough to splutter, "What brought this on?" Zhukov patiently explained the considerations, but sensing the general's outrage and humiliation, he quietly suggested that Yeremenko call back later. In 15 minutes, when the phone conversation resumed, Yeremenko had not gotten control of himself. "I can't understand. Please tell Stalin I want to stay here until the enemy is completely destroyed." Zhukov suggested he tell Stalin himself, and Yeremenko said he had already tried, but was unable to get through Poskribishev, Stalin's personal secretary, who had insisted that all such matters were Zhukov's responsibility. On behalf of the shattered Yeremenko, Zhukov called Stalin immediately, but the premier remained adamant about placing Rokossovsky in charge. Retreating to his private quarters south of Stalingrad, Andrei Yeremenko burst into tears. When Nikita Khrushchev tried to calm him, he was furious. "Comrade, you don't understand. You're a civilian. You forget how we thought we were doomed, how Stalin used to ask if we could hold out for 3 more days. We all thought the Germans would capture Stalingrad and we would be made scapegoats. Maybe you don't foresee what will happen, but I do. The new Don Front will get all the glory for the Stalingrad victory, and our armies at the Southern Front will be forgotten." Khrushchev could not console his friend. The German counterattack against Russian General Badanov's 24th Tank Corps had temporarily regained control of Moro and Tazi, the airstrips for the shuttle to Stalingrad. But the triumph proved of little consequence, for bad weather and faulty equipment continued to plague the Luftwaffe. Tonnage into the Kessel wavered between 80 and 200 tons daily. Hundreds of Russian anti-aircraft batteries were now emplaced along the flight path, in direct line with the German radio beacon to Pitomnik, and they began to take an awesome toll of the lumbering transports. In just 5 weeks, nearly 300 of them were shot down. Pitomnik airfield itself mirrored the mounting disaster of 6th Army. The pulse of the Kessel, it lay in the middle of an arterial network of highways that drew a microcosm of despair and hope to its runways and buildings. These roads had been kept clear for weeks by Major Linden's special task force, but even his Herculean efforts faltered before the terrible handicaps imposed by the winter storms. As his men worked in blizzards, the brutal winds forced them to wear gas masks to protect their faces from frostbite. When one storm ended, another began. Though snowplows moved up and down the arteries constantly, eventually the acute shortage of fuel slowed their schedule, bringing Major Linden to the brink of despair. As the new year approached, the roads to Pitomnik clogged again with drifts. On either side of the highways, soldiers now stuck the legs of hundreds of dead horses into the snow as trail markers for truck drivers. Colonel Lothar Rosenfeld, a former police boxing champion, monitored the field's heartbeat. Riding a small pongee pony, he maintained rigid discipline over both the air shuttle and the hordes of wounded and couriers seeking passage from the pocket. One of his frequent visitors was Hitler's liaison officer, Major Coelestine von Zitzewitz, who had been suspect since the day he arrived from Supreme Headquarters as an observer. From the beginning, General Arthur Schmidt and some others had held Zitzewitz at arm's length, and shortly after his arrival, Schmidt even interfered with one of his dispatches to East Prussia. Convinced that Zitzewitz was painting too grim a picture at that time in early December, Schmidt insisted on altering the message to reflect a more optimistic tone. Zitzewitz had learned his lesson. From then on, he only sent off reports after Schmidt had gone to bed. Far from being a yes man, the major wrote unvarnished accounts of the debacle he witnessed. He went everywhere, to the frontline foxholes, to hospitals, ammunition dumps, and icy ravines. In the mile-long Balkas at Babrkin, Gorodishchi, and Dmitrievka, he followed German troops into their dark, clammy bunkers, where lack of fuel spawned colds, pneumonia, and an increased weakness to other infections. Improper sanitation in these refuges was also bringing out armies of lice. Zitzewitz sat among hordes of mice and rats that overran the bunkers and gnawed scraps of food hoarded by Germans in knapsacks and pockets. The rodents were ravenous. He witnessed one case where they even descended on a soldier whose feet were badly frostbitten. While he slept, they chewed off two of his toes. Above all, Zitzewitz monitored Pitomnik, where the wounded crowded into hastily laid-out hospitals and waited for doctors to ease their pain while the Junkers and Heinkels circled and landed or flamed and crashed. The major spared nothing in his attempt to alert Hitler to the whole truth, but his grim reports had an unanticipated impact at the Wolf's Lair. In discussing them, Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring shook his head in disbelief. It is impossible that any German officer could be responsible for defeatist messages of this sort, he declared. The only possible explanation is that the enemy has captured his transmitter and has sent them himself. Thus, Zitzewitz's reports were dismissed as Russian propaganda. Stragglers from the Italian Eighth Army could have assured Hermann Göring that Zitzewitz's chronicles of despair were totally authentic. They were still plodding through knee-deep snow toward far-off prison camps. Lieutenant Felice Bracci had continued marching in a northerly direction, across the silvery ice of the Upper Don River that he once hoped to ford as a conqueror. Now he was sure it was a bewitched stream, never to succumb to an invader's boots. For several agonizing days, Bracci had kept his mind and body functioning as the long black snake of captives passed numerous villages where Russian women unaccountably smiled and threw crusts of bread and frozen potatoes into his outstretched hands. Some Russians exchanged food for wedding rings, clothing, or blankets. When Bracci offered a piece of adhesive tape from a roll he had saved, a villager thrust a large piece of black bread at him in payment. Bracci wolfed it down in seconds. On December 28th, Russian guards stopped the Italians at a huge barracks near a railroad station. Jammed into the dark building with hundreds of other prisoners, Bracci spent the next 3 days clinging to sanity. Some of his friends had contracted gangrene from frostbite and screamed without let-up. Italian doctors amputated the worst limbs with homemade knives, and the moans of the patients, operated on without anesthesia, drove everyone to despair. Surrounded by bedlam, by prayers for God's mercy, Bracci and his comrades scrounged bits of wood and lit small fires in a corner of the room. The tiny blazes nourished them somewhat while the Russians subjected them to a propaganda campaign. Two Soviet officers, one a woman, came into the barracks and, speaking fluent Italian, they asked why Bracci and his friends had come to wage war on Russia and whether the soldiers were really fascists. The Russians told the captives that Mussolini and Hitler were finished and ended their harangue with the lie that King Victor Emmanuel had died recently of a broken heart. The woman then took out scraps of paper and pencils and asked the prisoners to write messages back to loved ones in Italy. Taking a pencil in his numbed fingers, Bracci wrote, "I am alive, I am well." He had no hope that his words would ever arrive in Rome. The propaganda barrage continued into the next day, when all the Italian officers were lined up to hear a speech from a bespectacled civilian speaking from atop a car. In flawless Italian, the man cursed the fascist government and warned his listeners that it was extremely unlikely they would ever leave Russia alive. The cold, he claimed, would mow them down. Shivering in formation, Bracci wondered whether the speaker would mention starvation as a factor contributing to his imminent death, but the expatriate Italian did not. When he finished, the prisoners had to parade past a cameraman who filmed their misery for some unknown audience. On New Year's Eve, Bracci tried to forget his plight. Lying on the frozen barracks floor, He listened as Colonel Rosati took his comrades on a gourmet visit of Rome's best restaurants, the elegant Z, the Barsogliara, and on to the dining room atop the Tarpeian Rock. When the colonel recited the meal he would order in each establishment, his audience groaned. Thursday, gnocchi. Rosati savored the words, and men chewed endlessly on nothing. Spittle formed in their mouths, their stomachs churned. Someone told Rosati to shut up, but the protester was shouted down by others desperate to hold off reality. Saturday, tripe, the colonel went on, and added mellow white wines to the menu. Outside the barracks, a roaring wind blew gusts of snow through the paneless windows onto the huddled diners. Ignoring the chill, they listened raptly. Monday, cannelloni in cream sauce. At 10 p.m. on December 31st, Russian artillery around the Kessel exploded in a frenzied acknowledgement of the holiday. Because they knew Soviet gunners were operating on Moscow time, 2 hours ahead of German clocks, 6th Army troops had prepared for the deluge. Hunkered down in their holes, they rode out the 15-minute salvo, welcoming in a year of promised glory for Soviet Russia. Inside Stalingrad, the expectations of Russian troops ran high. The ice bridge across the Volga was the main reason for their attitude. From Aktuba and Krasnaya Sloboda, hundreds of trucks now crossed the river daily, bringing white camouflage suits to replace tattered gray-brown uniforms. In the middle of the river, traffic masters waved food convoys to depots set up under the cliff. Cases of American canned goods began to litter foxholes strung along the defense line from Tsaritsa to the tractor works. Ammunition piled up to the point where Russian gunners now fired anti-tank shells at lone German soldiers. On New Year's Eve, discipline in the revitalized 62nd Army relaxed, and along the shore, high-ranking Soviet officers held a series of parties to honor actors, musicians, and ballerinas visiting Stalingrad to entertain the troops. One of the troop members, violinist Mikhail Goldstein, stayed away and went instead into the trenches to perform another of his one-man concerts for the soldiers. In all the war, Goldstein had never seen a battlefield quite like Stalingrad, a city so utterly broken by bombs and artillery, cluttered with skeletons of hundreds of horses, picked clean by the starving enemy. And always there were the grim police of the Russian NKVD, standing between the front line and the Volga, checking soldiers' papers and shooting suspected deserters dead. The horrible battlefield shocked Goldstein, and he played as he never played before, hour after hour, for men who obviously loved his music. And while all German works had been banned by the Soviet government, Goldstein doubted that any commissar would protest on New Year's Eve. The melodies he created drifted out through loudspeakers to the German trenches, and the shooting suddenly ceased. In the eerie quiet, the music flowed from Goldstein's dipping bow. When he finished, a hushed silence hung over the Russian soldiers. From another loudspeaker in German territory, a voice broke the spell. In halting Russian, it pleaded, "Play some more Bach. We won't shoot." Goldstein picked up his violin and started a lively Bach gavotte. At the stroke of midnight, Berlin time, a soldier of the German 24th Panzer Division at the northeastern part of the Kessel raised his machine pistol and fired a magazine full of tracer bullets into the sky. Others in his unit spontaneously followed his salute. The idea flared quickly along the perimeter west to the 16th Panzers, then to the 60th Motorized, and on around the curve to the Marinovka Nose, through the 3rd Motorized and down to the 29th Division, eastward along the southern edge of the pocket, past the 297th and 371st to the Volga, and back to the darkened streets of Stalingrad, where men poked rifles and machine guns through slits and blasted an arc of kaleidoscopic fireworks above the brooding bulk of the factories. The rainbow of fire circled the fortress for minutes as German soldiers welcomed a new year shorn of hope. To those standing in the middle of the steppe around Pitomnik and Gumrak, the pyrotechnics proved only the futility of the German position. The entire horizon was a band of flame from tracer bullets, but they formed a complete circle of fire around 6th Army. On the first day of 1943, Adolf Hitler remembered Paulus at Stalingrad. To you and your brave army I send, also in the name of the whole German population, my warmest New Year's wishes. I am aware of the difficulty of your responsibility. The heroic attitude of your troops is appreciated. You and your soldiers should begin the new year with a strong faith that I and the German Wehrmacht will use all strength to relieve the defenders of Stalingrad and make their long wait the highest achievement of German war history. At an officer's mess inside the Kessel, blond Lieutenant Hans Odell was surrounded by men wishing him a happy birthday. Seated in front of his own blue china, from which he had eaten for years, he watched a cook ladle out a huge steaming portion of goulash filled with thick chunks of meat. Astounded and delighted, Odell began to eat. The door suddenly burst open, and a military policeman stormed in, demanding to know whether anyone had seen his watchdog. In the sudden silence, Hans Odell looked at his companions, now staring uncomfortably at the floor. Then his gaze returned slowly to the goulash and mountain of meat in front of him. While the policeman thundered threats against anyone who might have killed his pet, the lieutenant deliberately raised his fork and chewed a portion of the policeman's German Shepherd. Sergeant Albert Pfluger had waited patiently for a flight home, but when bad weather closed off most of the shuttle, he suddenly made up his mind to go back to his men in the 297th Division. Still drugged by pills and nearly crazed by the itching of lice under the cast on his arm, he hitched a ride to a railroad siding near Karpovka and boarded the small train that ran for a few miles toward the suburbs of Stalingrad. In a freight car, Pfluger found company, two Romanian enlisted men and six Romanian officers, who stood menacingly over them. While the train moved along in fitful starts and stops, one officer told Pfluger the soldiers were prisoners who had been condemned to death for stealing food. While they talked, for some reason Pfluger could not fathom, another officer suddenly whipped the two men mercilessly. At Pishenka, Pfluger jumped down from this depressing scene, and within hours he found his first sergeant, who greeted him exuberantly and took him to his old unit. In only a few days, six of Pfluger's men had been wounded or killed, but the survivors welcomed him, and the company butcher showered him with hoarded chocolate, cigarettes, and tins of meat. Glad to be back with his own people, Pfluger quickly dismissed the memory of missing the flight at Pitomnik. In Novocherkassk, Field Marshal Erich von Manstein greeted the new year in a somber mood. His attempt to save Paulus was a failure, and he knew that the fate of the Sixth Army was sealed. But another crisis of even greater magnitude was at hand. 400 miles south of Stalingrad, Army Group A, comprising the 1st Panzer and 17th Armies, stood alone and vulnerable in the foothills of the Caucasus Mountains. Unless Manstein brought these armies north, safely through the bottleneck city of Rostov, the Russian High Command could effect the super Stalingrad Kessel that Stalin sought. Ever since Manstein had pulled Hermann Hoth's panzers back from the relief effort toward Stalingrad, he had phoned daily demands to East Prussia for the prompt withdrawal of the Germans in the Caucasus, and only on December 29th had Adolf Hitler authorized the retreat of the 1st Panzer Army. Now, on New Year's Day, they finally turned their vehicles around and bolted for safety. As their Mark III's and IVs drummed northward, the tankers were praying that Manstein would hold Rostov open long enough to save their lives. Chapter 25. From the beginning of the encirclement, German military sensors outside the Kessel had kept careful watch on the mail flown from Pitomnik to Germany. At first, the monitors estimated that more than 90% of the letter writers exuded both complete confidence in their leaders and in their own ability to endure hardships caused by temporary reliance on the airlift. Also, because they had been involved in other temporary cauldrons in the lightning-fast panzer actions of past years, German troops had had little difficulty relating those defeats turned to victory to the predicament they faced at Stalingrad. Had not General Seydlitz-Kurzbach himself been involved in the rescue of 100,000 Germans at Damansk in central Russia the past winter? Thus, the initial avalanche of mail to the Reich reflected an apparently unshakable conviction that the Wehrmacht was still invincible. That conviction had held until Christmas. Between that day and the end of the year, however, censors noted a sharp decline in morale. Men began to demand better mail delivery and a speed-up of parcels from home to supplement dwindling rations. They also complained openly about the cold, averaging 20 degrees below zero, and bemoaned the incessant snowfall, the lice, fleas, and rats. Still, the majority of Germans in the Kessel seemed to retain a spirit of defiance and hope, or so they told their loved ones. One man wrote, "Our weapons and our command are the best in the world." Another boasted, "We gladly make every sacrifice for our country in hopes that our people will see better times than we do." A third said, "Of course, we will always be the stronger ones. There can be no doubt about that." Two enlisted men breathed both defiance and a rigid belief in the regime that had led them to the Kessel. On December 30th, one, a corporal, APO number 36025, had written, "Don't get any false ideas. The victor can only be Germany. Any battle requires sacrifices, and you should be proud to know that your son is in the very center of the decision. How pleased I will be to stand before you someday with all my medals, and to prove my valor to Uncle Willy, who always told us boys that our first goal was to become a man during combat. I remember those words all the time. We know what is at stake as far as our country is concerned. We love our country now more than ever before. Germany shall live even though we may have to die." On December 31st, the other, a private first class, APO number 24836B, wrote, "The Russians are flooding us with leaflets. When I come home, I shall show you some of the nonsense that they are writing. They want us to surrender. Do they really believe we are puppets for them? We will fight to the last man and the last bullet. We will never capitulate. We are in a difficult position in Stalingrad, but we are not forsaken. Our Führer will not leave us in the lurch. We will receive help, and we shall endure. If we have a little less to eat, and if we have to do without many other things, it does not matter. We shall endure." In their mail analysis, censors flashed a warning signal to higher authorities about what to expect when January came. It must be expected that there will be a decline in morale as hope for relief wanes. The censor's prediction proved alarmingly accurate. An abrupt, fatal change in mood occurred, and the number of farewell letters increased dramatically. The tone of these messages reflected the sudden awareness that events were narrowing each man's prospects of survival to infinitesimal percentages. When last wills and testaments multiplied, censors tried to be delicate in their excisions of material. Using pens or pencils to match that used by the sender, they smudged over words or made them illegible, as though the writer himself had made the errors. One discouraged officer told his family, "You can't starve those swine. They have absolute air superiority here, day and night. Nothing but those rapacious birds. I cannot imagine an end to this, and that is what really gets you down." A surgeon writing to his wife was brutally frank with her about life in the Kessel. He described how he had just taken off a man's leg at the thigh with a pair of scissors and how the patient endured the hideous surgery without anesthesia. A corporal mirrored a growing sentiment. "To tell you the truth, I would rather meet with sudden death than pine away gradually." Quartermaster Karl Binder wrote his 26th letter from the Russian front. It was another poignant attempt to prepare his family for death. "My dearest wife, I am still alive and all right. Today, Sunday, I attended the funeral of several soldiers of my bakery company. It is cruel what you witness in the cemeteries. Should I ever return home, I will never forget what I have seen. It is an epic second to none. I am sorry that I have not received any letters from you since December 5th. I would be so happy to read a word of love from you, for one does not know what the next hour, the next day, will have in store. My dearest wife, come what may, I am prepared for everything. When the time comes, I shall die a soldier. God is with us every hour." These were the words of the Protestant minister at the cemetery, which is overflowing. It increases in dimension like an avalanche, but the brutal enemy is still kept under control. He will not succeed in overwhelming us, as long as I have one hand that can hold a weapon. Time is now so short that I must concern myself about the end of everything. I have lived my life, not always a pious one, and life has always handled me roughly. There have been times when a spark of carelessness or passion controlled my heart, but I have always endeavored to be decent, a comrade, a soldier. I also tried to be a good husband to you and a good father to the children. I don't know if I was successful. Probably I was too harsh, but I had only one thing in mind, your happiness. It is too late to change anything, apart from the fact that I don't know what I could change. But I love all of you more than ever. Bring up the children for their benefit. Life has not provided me with much sunshine. Most of it came from you and the children. So let me thank you here and now. With us, death is a daily guest. He has lost all his horrors for me. In case I fall, move to Schwäbisch Gmünd as soon as possible. Life is cheaper there. There are 1,900 Reichsmark on my account at the post office savings bank. My belongings are in a small suitcase, a big handbag, a boot bag, and perhaps a small wooden suitcase. I don't know if you will get these things. The Garrison Liquidation Office and the Maintenance Board in Stuttgart will give you information about your pension. Throw away my uniforms. The rest is yours. I wish you and the children all the best for the future. Let us hope that we shall be reunited in the other world. Don't be sad. The worst may not happen. But I feel urged to set everything in order. God's will be done. So never say die. I won't either, in spite of everything. All my love and affectionate kisses to you. I shall love you unto death. Carl. My love and kisses to the dear children. Chapter 26. In the first days of January, German observation posts along the southern and western sides of the Kessel phoned in alarming reports of a massive Russian buildup. Observers counted hundreds of T-34 tanks churning through the snow, plus troop-carrying trucks that brazenly roared past German outposts to hidden points of concentration just over the horizon. Then there were the heavy guns, thousands of them wheeling by, from the multi-barreled Katyusha rocket launchers to 210mm siege howitzers. In their cramped holes, the Germans were powerless to interfere. Ammunition had to be saved for an actual attack. Knowing their enemy was impotent, Russian soldiers set up huge field kitchens from which the aroma of hot food wafted toward 6th Army foxholes. This sensual torture was worse for the Germans than seeing the tanks and guns that spelled imminent disaster. Joseph Stalin had finally put his generals in motion to crush Paulus. Artillery genius Nikolai Nikolaevich Voronov appeared at the edge of the Kessel to lend his authority to plans for the final offensive. On a line 7 miles long, he proposed the installation of 7,000 guns, more than enough to burst through the German perimeter. Another key part in the new Soviet offensive was delegated to Vasily Chuikov in the city of Stalingrad. Aware that Paulus still kept 7 divisions along the Volga despite manpower shortages elsewhere on his flanks, Stavka assigned his 62nd Army a significant tactical role in the final liquidation of the pocket. Chuikov learned of this when a distinguished visitor, General Konstantin Rokossovsky, came across the Volga to his cliffside bunker. Sitting on an earthen bench, the front commander gave Chuikov the details. While simultaneous attacks were being mounted from west, north, and south, 62nd Army had to attract more enemy forces in its direction, preventing them from reaching the Volga if they try to break out of encirclement. When Rokossovsky asked whether the 62nd Army could contain any such desperate enemy maneuver, General Krylov, Chuikov's chief aide, answered for his superior. If in the summer and autumn all Paulus's forces were unable to drive us into the Volga, then the hungry and frozen Germans won't even move 6 steps eastward. Each day, 62nd Army shock troops continued to intimidate these hungry and frozen Germans, who gave ground slowly as they scurried from cellar to cellar. Firefights erupted endlessly in workshops, apartment houses, and workers' homes, all mere shells by now, but filled with desperate human beings, at bay and dangerous. Trapped for more than 3 months in their concrete barn behind German lines, Natasha Kornilov and her mother lay under a blanket on the icy floor and listened to a sudden flurry of grenade explosions and staccato bursts from machine guns. The 11-year-old girl had just come back from her daily trip to garbage heaps on the streets. Once again, she had failed to find any food. Since the beginning of the encirclement, Natasha had come home empty-handed most of the time, and by now, she was finding it extremely difficult to gather enough strength to walk out the door. But she always did, for otherwise she knew her mother would die of starvation. Beside her, under the blanket, Mrs. Kornilov had watched her 11-year-old daughter waste away. The child's eyes bugged out from a hollowed face. Her dress hung limply on a skeletal frame. The girl's arms were like broomsticks. Though neither dared to voice her fears to the other, each wondered how long they could go on. Each prayed that the other would not die and leave the survivor alone in the concrete barn. Gunfire outside rose to a crescendo. Bullets pinged off the walls. The door flew open and a soldier trained his rifle on the figures under the covers. Natasha heard him say something in a guttural voice. Then hands reached down and someone was gruffly telling her that everything was all right. Natasha smiled weakly into the bearded face of a Russian infantryman. 25 miles to the west, Pitomnik Airport was rapidly deteriorating into a living hell. At the two main medical stations, German doctors had been overwhelmed by an influx of wounded. Patients begged for medication to stop their pain. But with drugs in short supply, medics were forced to issue them only to the worst cases. Outside the hospitals, countless bodies lay unburied. So far, however, the corpses were being stacked in neat rows for future interment. A few of the passengers on outgoing planes looked remarkably healthy. Specialists and administrators, they had been ordered to leave the pocket to form the nucleus of new divisions. Some benefited from General Seidlitz's abortive attempt to force a retreat in November. The staff of the 94th Division boarded Junkers and embarked on a mission to rebuild that ghost organization. Their division veterinarian, Herbert Wrench, stayed behind to dispose of his livestock. His camels had just been slaughtered, and now Wrench processed the last of his 1,200 horses for food. But he still refused to send his own horse, Lori, to the knife. Though she had lost most of her strength, when Wrench looked at her, he could not order her destruction. He rationalized his decision by thinking that one